Hello, and welcome to this special publication for the Journal of Critical Digital Librarianship. This project and this publication is called Let Us Fail, Speculative Futures in Digital Librarianship. I'm Natalia Estrada. My pronouns are she and they. I am the Digital Scholarship Librarian at the University of Buffalo, and I would like to introduce my collaborators. Let us start with Christina.
Hi, I am Christina Bush. I use she, her pronouns, and I am currently the online learning librarian at Tufts University's Tisch Library.
I'm Stacey Snyder, pronouns are she, her, and I'm Educational Technology Project Manager in the University of Buffalo Libraries.
So now that we've figured out who we are in that basic sense, we kind of also have to discuss, how did we get to here? How did we get to this idea? And why are we recording this podcast for a journal publication on this topic? And why we're doing something that's called Let Us Fail? So why don't we start with you, Stacey? How did we get here?
Oh, it's a long and winding road. Personally, I got here, I was in library school in the mid-90s. And that's, of course, when the World Wide Web came to be. So I've been playing around with digital stuff since I got out of library school, from doing digital collections to most recently working with our digital scholarship studio and network. So I've been working a lot along the years with the evolution of digital library spaces. I think with the subject librarians, that they, and this is my impression from the outside of that,
yeah,
but the thought that they are first and foremost focused on their subjects and yeah, that to do what they need to do to help those faculty along, to get the resources that they need, whereas I was seen and have been seen as one of the IT people. So doing all of those things with the computer and the programs and the testing is what IT people do. And certainly there's been kind of a split between, you know, the hierarchy that is in higher education between faculty and staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I have certainly felt that over the years, that the faculty are at a higher level in the hierarchy than staff are. So while I feel like my expertise hasn't been challenged, I think that in some ways my librarianness has been challenged. Hardly anything overt, although I have heard from faculty librarians that, well, you're not really a librarian because I'm not in that position. So no, I'm not in a librarian position, but I still have the degree. I work in libraries. I understand how the library field exists and what's different in doing any sort of IT in a library versus doing IT in another organization.
What about you, Christina?
Yeah, so I'm still pretty new to this profession. When I was in undergrad, I got really involved in a digital humanities project, and it opened my eyes to thinking about, wow, like what can digital tools and these methodologies do with all of the amazing things that libraries have? Like, what would that combination of digital tools and the access that they can create to archival materials, where can that take us? So I went into library school thinking, like, this is exactly what I'm going to do. And then I ended up getting really interested in instruction. Like, I just became such a pedagogy nerd and absolutely love teaching. And my first job out of library school, which I went to right after undergrad, was at UC Berkeley, which is where I met Natalia. And it was the digital literacies librarian. So to me, that felt like a really cool intersection of the digital world that I was coming out of and the instruction world that I had become really interested in. And my current job is online learning. So I've kind of stayed at that intersection of instructional design and the digital world and digital scholarship. throughout my career so far. So that's what got me here, is kind of thinking these big picture questions about the digital world, digital landscape that we operate in, and where libraries, especially academic libraries, fit in there. I remember the first time that I heard digital humanities as well, which was after I had been involved with that project for, I think, like 2 years at that point. And I had joined this minor that was in public history and archives. And the instructor that I was working with, he's like, you know, the minor also has digital humanities, and this is a digital humanities project. And I was like, what is this word? And after that, I was like, okay, this is what I want to do with my life, is I want to be a facilitator for DH research, because the possibilities are magical and felt endless to me at that point, you know, not knowing all that much about all of the roadblocks. But being involved with that project, I just thought, like, look what is possible when there's digital access to these materials that are spread across the globe. I was working with Syriac manuscripts. We had like 85% of all of the ones that still exist in the world today that are spread between many different countries and different libraries. And if this can be done with Syriac manuscripts, what can be done with anything else in the world? And it felt so inspiring.
I feel like I have two different paths to talk about how we got here and how I got here, especially. So I have my path of how I got into librarianship, and where I kind of didn't intend to become a librarian. I just generally knew when I was going through undergrad that I really liked research, but I had also worked in a library as an undergrad. I also ended up graduating into the recession in 2008. And so I just essentially was finding jobs, anything I could do. So I got a lot of library jobs that were mostly staff positions. And in those positions, it was a lot of very much someone else told me what to do. I had very little freedom, very little autonomy of what I could do. And so if I was very curious about anything, like, oh, I want to learn like Drupal because this would help in this project that seems very interesting. Or, hey, I see this trend is happening. It was very much the decision of somebody higher. And so they could say either yes or no on whether I got to learn these things, whether I got to try something. It wasn't until I became librarian, big L librarian, that I had more freedom to try different things, to do what I felt was best. And it was also, you know, right around that transition that I actually attended, thanks to the ARL, what was then the Initiative to Recruit a Diverse Workforce, what is now Kaleidoscope, giving me funding to go to the Digital Scholarship Institute, where I met Stacy and learned different aspects of digital humanities, digital scholarship there. And so I was able to take those skill sets and be able to try out some stuff. I became a librarian over at Berkeley, eventually in political science, public policy, where I also got to work with Christina. The pandemic happened. We had to transition to a lot of things where things were digital. And so we had to be more innovative on these things. And then I ended up in Buffalo, where it was a whole different, you know, need, different function, where it just became all these different environments that I wanted to be able to explore, but also different kind of relationship. Parallel to that is also my general path to digital landscapes. I actually got very late to the internet, to most people. I didn't get the internet at home. So I grew up in LA, fairly low income. I didn't get internet until like 2003, which for most people is actually kind of late. And so I didn't really have access to like that early landscape of the internet. I didn't get much access to like a computer by myself until much later and stuff like that. So I feel very behind in compared to my peers. And so I feel like I've constantly had to like play catch up. The first year and a half of my college program, I did not have a computer of my own. And so that made it really tricky. I also avoided all computer classes because I felt like if I don't have my own computer, there's no point in me having this. So I was very much a person who lived in the libraries and the computer labs to be able to just type up my papers or the access my like class boards to do assignments, email. That was my second home, was the computer labs. And so that made me very self-conscious about, like, you know, how people perceived my ability to work with a computer and how, like, my understanding of what's going on, say, like, with the internet and stuff like that throughout college. And also just, like, class and how much money I had and, like, what came with those signifiers. The longer I went on through college, the more apparent it became. Half of my classmates had MacBooks or like some other expensive hardware, stuff like that. When I finally was able to get my own computer, it was just like we got it from Best Buy for like less than $400 and it would break down every time. You know, I missed out on a lot of the like learning things that a lot of my classmates learned on how to work with their machines and stuff. I was just more self-conscious and being like, don't break. I just need you to do a Word document. Like, don't die. Or even just like taking on more intensive kind of projects as well. I took a linguistics course that required downloading software. And I was so afraid, like my introduction to Audacity was in this class. And I was so afraid that Audacity was going to break my computer. And from then on, like, after that, and after a series of like having to replace computers that were very cheap, that wouldn't last very long and things like that, I just learned over time of like, you know, trying to figure out like, how can I pretend I at least know how to work with a computer and also like be able to stay connected to how other people in the general academic sphere work with a computer. I feel like my whole experience from there makes me more empathetic to how people work with a computer and stuff. I'm slightly more proficient at working with a computer, but not enough to where I can be confident about it. I still feel imposter syndrome, but at the same time, I'm always like, you know, trying to understand. I always feel for like students who can't afford, for people who can't like have reliable internet and stuff like that. And so that kind of really helps drive how I view my practice in digital librarianship and digital scholarship and just librarianship in general. It's just like, I've been there. I know what it's like. Let's make it a little bit easier and less sucky for like the next generation. I do also want to say before we go on with our conversation, we are three women, cisgender women. We are either white or white presenting. We are at institutions where we have some flexibility, and we do have at least a master's degree amongst us. I believe that gives us a little bit of position in understanding only certain aspects of how that affects, you know, the experience of digital librarianship. We do acknowledge that other people say like who are Black, brown, queer, transgender, whatnot, have a totally different experience in digital librarianship, and we can't really speak to that. We want to at least acknowledge that.
Something else we want to acknowledge is that the work of speculative futures and speculative futuring is firmly rooted in the Black experience, and the people who pioneered speculative futures are Black. So we definitely want to like acknowledge that history of race and speculative futurism and pay homage to that in our work.
Speculative futuring is a design practice that grew out of speculative fiction. Speculative fiction is a genre that includes works in which the setting is other than the real world and explores possibilities and impossibilities of the world. One originator of this genre is Octavia Butler, who explored racism and oppression on Earth through science fiction plots, including alien colonialism. Speculative fiction is deeply rooted in Black history and culture. Imagining a new world in which oppressive factors like racism, capitalism, and colonialism exist in different ways or not at all is part of the challenge of speculative futures. Speculative futures is a mindset of building a world in which we can enact change and visualize potential worlds beyond what currently exists.
So one other thing we should mention, and this will go on to another part of this, is that there's a reason why we picked the podcast format, which is this, you know, allows an accessibility format, a difference in accessibility, and especially in terms of neurodiversity access. So I should say I am what is considered neurodivergent. I am both autistic and have ADHD. And so doing something that allows a different medium in scholarly publication is a little bit of a freedom for me to be able to do something that allows me more access. And this kind of ties into aspects of critical disability studies and being able to do those kinds of freedoms.
Something else that I wanted to bring up was I read in Crip Negativity that what the quote is that Crips need more futures. And in that book, the author uses Crips to describe disabled people. That's his terminology. So Crips need more futures because the only one that has been given to us is reproductive normativity and rehabilitative futurism. So a future that does not include disability. So erases people who are suffering from disabilities or who have disabilities from those futures that are imagined. And that futurity has been the cause of a lot of violence against disabled people.
So this is from Crip Negativity by Jonathan Logan Smilges. It was published in 2023 from the University of Minnesota Press.
So we want to be speculating a future also for those who were not given a future to begin with. So for disabled people, for people of color, people who have been removed from futures historically. So that's part of our challenge here, too, is to be able to come up with a future that includes everyone and lets people have that humanity to them. So, I mean, we're very much focusing on digital librarianship here. So we, but
which is still people.
Yes,
and it's still people. Humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's actually a really great way of framing this whole conversation, where it is just like the idea of like, these are for to make sure that everybody who normally wouldn't see themselves in these spaces, folks who are disabled, you know, like yourself and neurodivergent, like myself, people of color, folks who have been marginalized in different areas can actually see themselves and be able to like try out these spaces and be in these spaces in a way that brings joy and play. So we should also talk about our institutions and especially the difference between Christina, you are at a private institution right now.
Yes.
Stacey and I, we're at a state institution. So there is a lot of difference with that. Stacey, do you see any, what are the differences to you that you've noticed?
It's an odd paradox of more and less freedom. More freedom in that we're kind of ultimately accountable to the public, to our fellow New York State residents. So in some ways we're more free to explore, I think. But on the other hand, a private institution might have more funding available and might be able to step around boundaries that as a state institution, we have to pay attention to. You know, there are a lot of rules around purchasing, for example, because we're accountable to the state. So, you know, if we want to buy something that is over a certain dollar amount, it has to go to bid. We, you know, there's a favor for, as I think it should be, women and minority owned companies, that sort of thing. Whereas with a private institution, my understanding is that they can just do business with whomever they want, whenever they want, without those restrictions. So, and I think that it's good and bad to have those kinds of restrictions involved.
I'll also add on that for a state institution, we do try to attract the attention of not only citizens of the state and our general area to show what work we've done, but to help validate and maybe increase donations, which is kind of this like kind of a dangerous land to be in, where you have to really hope that someone wants to give you money to work on a project or pay for resources, things like that. you know, there was a recent announcement of a very large donation, but it's only for a certain division of the campus. And so it's not very spread equitably. And also, there is this whole consideration of, like, who are we answering to? Who do we do these projects for? Whether it is for just for the sake of ourselves, or whether it's for, like, the greater Western New York area, or for the general state of New York. What is it like over at a private institution, Christina?
Yeah, we definitely also have a lot of rules about funding and acquisitions. So a lot of the money comes from alums who have donated for particular causes, and they'll say, you know, however much money, and only for classics related acquisitions. And we can only do so much fudging of that as far as being able to expand where we want to put money towards to grow with the direction of the university. And Tufts has definitely been trying to do more like DEIJ oriented work. Also, like, the undergrad enrollment here is like less than 7,000. It's a small university. And we do try to support like research interests for our faculty, especially, and collect where their research interests lie. And that also kind of is how we're staffed and how we work is like the research and instruction department is fairly small, and the majority of it is subject librarians who work closely with their faculty and are kind of more like graduate student focused. And then my department, which is user experience and student success, there are four of us, and we're responsible for the undergrads. So like it's a really small environment within the library as well. So like in comparison to UC Berkeley, there are so many fewer librarians, and it's the kind of thing where, you know, the work keeps getting piled on because we're all trying to do so many people's jobs and so much work, and we're all trying to adapt to the new needs of our students and the new needs of this university as more digital needs appear, especially after the pandemic, and being able to adapt to what we've seen our students need now and how they liked having hybrid options and learning remotely and really being responsible for their own education and being able to access content whenever and wherever and really, you know, have agency over their learning. So the library has been trying to adapt to that. We've been really trying to be responsive to our community, but sometimes it's like, you know, one person muscling towards an outcome and like trying to bring people with us. But yeah, like what you're talking about with community, we are, Tisch Library is open to the public, but I don't think our community knows that or particularly feels welcome. Like I've received like virtual reference chats where people will say, oh, well, when can I come when it won't be too busy with students? Or am I allowed to come as a community member and not feel particularly invited into the space? So people from the community can come use our physical space, but they can't check out materials. So it's a different situation than y'all, where when we're talking about serving our community, it is much more like we're serving our researchers. We are serving the people who pay tuition here or work here, rather than we're serving the greater Medford or Somerville population.
I think that's a good point. I think that's also, in a way, a good transition over to what I think we should talk about next. This sense of like, do you feel welcome using these services and also just like coming in? Because even for a public institution, we still have members of our community who don't feel super welcome in our spaces or feel like that they can use our spaces both within physical spaces, but also digitally, which leads to what I think the next question that I want to bring up. So we've kind of been tossing these terms around without really giving a definition to them. And I think that we really, before we keep going, we should probably give definitions to. And the two terms that I'm thinking of is digital librarianship, and especially like just this general concept of like the digital landscape, but like digital librarianship, and also the idea of speculative futures. So who wants to take a crack at defining either one of those two?
For digital librarianship, There is a good quote from a book called Exploring Education for Digital Libraries. And I'm just going to quote it because it's better than me trying to paraphrase it. The ontology, the world of the digital librarian, can be understood to comprise knowledge creation, information flows, recording information in various ways and documents, digitization of information, and its transmission over networks, describing the physical and intellectual aspects of documents and human information behavior, including information seeking and making meaning. And I like that because I think it encompasses everything that we do in digital librarianship, because I think so often people just look at the output. So like the images that you put online or the book that you digitized or, you know, someone's dissertation that is online. And it's so much more than that. It goes into the end user and how people actually use and think about what we do in the digital library area.
Yeah, I like that. And I think especially if you want to paraphrase it, it's essentially digital librarianship. It's not digital archives.
Very good. Yes.
Or just like, it's not just managing digital collections and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I like this definition of just like this encompassing all different aspects. And it's not very far from what is considered general librarianship, where you are thinking of the user and how they use things. Christina, you talked about speculative futures a little bit earlier. Can you talk a little bit more of what that means?
Absolutely. So I also have a quote from the book Speculative Futures by Joanna Hoffman that says, speculative futures are design approaches that help us visualize new and potential worlds, move us beyond what currently exists into what could one day be. Inspired by art, film, fiction, and industrial design, they use speculation to provoke, imagine, and dream into what lies ahead. So that's a very designy definition of it. And I think that one would work well for us in this podcast, because what we are really doing here is trying to design and visualize a new world for digital librarianship and for us as digital librarians. So even that definition of digital librarianship that we took is almost speculative in a way, because it encompasses all of these potential new things that we can do with this field. And it's a more encompassing view of it than that traditional kind of association of digital libraries with just digital collections or digital archives. So I think we're already kind of doing that work of moving beyond what currently exists in digital librarianship to imagine what could one day be our job, right, as digital librarians. And like I said earlier, speculative future is rooted in the Black community, and like Octavia Butler is really like foundational here. So again, paying homage to her and her work.
There is one other factor that related to a lot of what's been going on in the year in the US is the general concept of work and labor. And Stacey, I think you were about to bring up an important point.
One of the differences between working here at the University of Buffalo and what Christina experiences at Tufts is, at the University of Buffalo, as part of the State University of New York, we are in a union. It's the United University Professions. It's everyone, all the faculty, professional staff in the State University of New York are part of this union. And so we have all of the benefits of what union membership brings to a person. And, you know, certainly there are some drawbacks to it, but I think, you know, overall, it's a benefit to have a union. Whereas, you know, Christina being in a non-union work environment has some very different experiences than we have. And I don't think that that's necessarily because of the size discrepancy, Tufts being much smaller than the University of Buffalo. But, you know, there are things as being part of the union that Natalia and I can be certain of. Our continued employment, for example. People to talk to if there are problems. formal grievance procedures, all of that, which may not necessarily be available to people who are not in a union environment.
So I think this is a good introduction to our project. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a lot of our talking points that we talked about here, and we're going to talk about some of the barriers that we face and also how we envision a future around those barriers. So thank you for listening to this first episode of Let Us Fail, Speculative Futures in Digital Librarianship.
We would like to thank Samantha Quinone-Snare for helping form and refine ideas for this project. We would also like to thank Chris Chung and CJ Keough for their technical assistance, and Yanina Mueller and Sophie Ziegler for providing feedback.